welcome to the Cloud Computing Show. My name is Gary Orenstein, host of the Cloud Computing Show. Co-hosting today with me is Edgard Capdevielle from the Cloud Strategy Group.
Hey, Gary.
Hey, Edgard. And we're really pleased to have a guest today, Kevin Brown, who is the former CEO of Kodaro, acquired by Microsoft, also a senior executive at Decru, which was acquired by NetApp, and a member of the founding team of Ink2Me, which was acquired by Yahoo. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
A pleasure to have you. So one housekeeping tip. We do have the Cloud Computing Show available on iTunes now. It is a work in progress to get everything flowing freely there, but I think it's operating. So please feel free to go to iTunes either from a link on the cloudcomputingshow.com homepage or in iTunes, do a quick search for the Cloud Computing Show and it should come up. And if you have any feedback there, please let us know. So we'll jump into industry news. Edgard, why don't you kick off a couple of the headlines there?
Sure. Well, this past week, IBM and SAP previewed cloud mobility at CeBIT, the German technology show. This demo was mostly based on IBM's Live Partition Mobility, which allows AIX logical partitions to be moved from one mainframe to a server or from one server to another. And this is very much in line with the announcements that VMware made a couple of weeks ago announcing their vCloud initiative and all the movement around the Cloud Computing Interoperability Forum, which it's all around the same topic of image mobility, compute mobility, and even application mobility. And again, it's advancing the underlying technologies of cloud. This is, I think, trouble for VMware, who just announced their major vCloud initiative. And it's trying to put kind of IBM in play for this.
Okay, I got to challenge you a little bit, and I don't mean any disrespect to IBM, but AIX is not necessarily the three-letter acronym that you expect to hear or think of as the big momentum builder behind cloud computing. So when I read this announcement, it seemed like it would probably – I think they did something specifically with an SAP application and migrating that from one data center to another. When you compare that and perhaps the customer set there versus – all the people who might want to or are using VMware. Is that really a fair comparison, Edgard?
I think it's an interesting step by IBM. It touches on the topic that we touched on the last podcast, which was cloud bursting and the ability to have a very, private infrastructure. And then when demand, is high, you go into move that application to a much larger environment. I'm not sure if this particular SAP IBM demo was about scalability, but it's kind of laying the foundation for that common cloud-based infrastructure.
This is Kevin. I will point out that virtualization isn't that new. It was invented back 30-plus years ago at IBM for the mainframes. And so it's interesting to see it come full circle here. It's also interesting to point out just some of the captive audience that IBM has in terms of the depth of their involvement with some of these customers. I think it's interesting. And they're also going to be running data centers that can move that workload out of the customers and into their compute set. So I think it's interesting. I'd agree that 100,000 VMware customers is a pretty big footprint to deal with. But I think you're seeing everyone really start to shift their strategies around this.
Yeah, I think it is great news for validation that application and virtual machine mobility are for real and that people are going to want to move those instances between not only between machines within one data center but also between data centers. So I think that's the takeaway for me.
If you're a software vendor, this is a chance to become obsolete pretty quick if you don't change yourself.
Yeah.
With a startup, AppZero is it's got their AppZero appliances, and they were demoed in the show Demo 2009, and they basically showed how the technology can migrate virtualized applications. So this is different than say VMware or the Citrix SAND platform. This guy's virtualized at the application layer, and they were able to move a virtualized application from an EC2 environment to a Go Grid environment, which I think, again, it's very powerful proof point of a different kind of technology, but also in the same mantra of moving an application from one environment to another.
Yeah, I thought this was very interesting. I mean, it is, you do have to wonder if every machine is using the same OS, does the OS need to be virtualized, or is it just the applications that might differ? To me, this is, you think about the time it takes to install an application on your desktop or your laptop and all the stuff that happens there. And to be able to just simply press a button instead and have the application be installed in seconds, I'm assuming is what happens, is is a pretty different take on moving up one layer in virtualization technology. I thought it was very interesting.
You've seen some of the analogies on the desktop side. So I came from a company that was doing desktop virtualization, which is now part of Microsoft, and we saw the same trend of making the desktop workloads more portable. So, for example, you could move them between a work computer and take them on a USB key, plug them into a home computer, and have essentially your digital personality be portable across multiple machines. I think that this is, again, one of those expectations that people have in terms of doing the work when they want and where it makes sense.
I guess my question is, how many virtualization containers are people going to use in the complete stack? And given the momentum of people like VMware or like Xen in the open source world, you know, what will people want to put another layer of application virtualization on top of that? I don't know the answer to that question.
I think there is some need for it because you've got the containers at the OS level, but there is still some management and deployment and delivery kind of requirement set. So, you know, VMware may get to it. They might buy someone. IBM might, you know, work on things. At Microsoft. All of these companies are trying to define what are the Russian dolls that you put together to make that sort of workload stack. And I think that's an open question.
So from your perspective then, Kevin, you think that both the OS virtualization and the application virtualization might be complementary and used in concert?
We absolutely believe that in our company when we were doing it for the desktop. And we've seen examples of where sometimes one is the right, sometimes the other is the right strategy.
Well, do you have any examples off the top of your head where, you know, where those two approaches might differ, like a focus on virtualizing at the OS level versus the application
level? Depends on where your pain is and what your work set looks like. So in a desktop example, you might have a real problem with managing and standardizing your operating systems. You may want to lock them down. You may want to do a lot of different things. So standardizing the operating system with virtualization, being able to update it and revert it and all those kinds of things might address a real problem for you. However, if you have many different types of workloads that different employees need to use and you're constantly having to customize those applications, if you can put them in containers and make them much more portable, much faster and easier to install, then you can take another different set of pain points, all, you know, sort of coming to the same machine, but you can really optimize a different set of problems. And, you know, ideally, customers are going to look to a full suite of products that can, you know, abstract at all those layers. And the more invisible it becomes, the better. But today, it's different products.
Gotcha.
One of the challenges that I found in this particular story was, you know, the leading edge aspect of each particular component. So you have AppZero, which is a brand new startup, you know, sexy in where it is, but very much a startup. You have EC2, which is trying to become a more enterprise type of service, but it's still dominating in the developer community. And GoGrid, whose compute service just released not too long ago. I think it's inside of a year. So everything here is brand new, leading edge. And if you're, you know, Fortune 100, Fortune 10 company, is this for you? And I think the answer is, you know, this probably needs a little bit of maturing.
Probably. I think that's big. You could say that about a lot of things with cloud computing. I wanted to point out a news item, this one perhaps more on the user consumer side of cloud computing, but a very relevant one regarding Google Docs. And we have an entire Google email and doc infrastructure at my company, so this one really struck a chord with me. I guess there was an error with Google Docs in that they had something where if you had previously shared a document with somebody but then removed that sharing, some of your more recent documents or those same documents were sort of reshared with people. So it wasn't that it was reshared to some stranger. It was someone you had worked with before. But it's a little bit scary to think that you could have inadvertently or through some error that took place at Google Docs, at the application itself, did that for you. And I have to say that using Google Docs as a day-to-day business tool is a little scary at times because the sharing is so easy and so simple, and the retention of email addresses in the fields where you put in who you'd like to share with will bring up people outside of your company as well as inside of your company. Now, the one good saving grace I think they have is that when you do share, when you're using a company-based Google Docs account and you share something outside of the company domain, it asks you, no matter what. So that gives you a level of protection there. But sometimes, you know, you can click through pretty quickly. So, I don't know, are you guys using any of these things? Have any of these concerns about what should be there, what shouldn't? And just wanted to open that discussion.
This is classic, and this is just the way that innovation happens. First, Anita's identified some people come up with things. Think of HTTP, right? You know, and it really was wide open, and it created this massive swell of content. Turns out it was very, you know, vulnerable. It had no security whatsoever built into it, and there was a mad scramble to then put in SSL and HTTPS. And this is true, you know, when I was in the storage industry, you know, they put $100 billion of storage into the racks. $100 billion, and not a lick of security anywhere in terms of real enforcement, real hardened OSs, real encryption. All the data was sitting there naked in clear text. You'd scroll it off onto a tape and hand it to a guy with tattoos from head to toe. So this is classic in the IT industry, and I think the cloud industry is going to come to terms with this probably sooner than others because security is a main objection for many of the big companies moving their data in, and incidents like this will just highlight that for anyone who wants to drag their feet and protect their own job to, you know, babysit servers in their company. So this is something that I think that to be successful, you know, companies like IBM understand it, but the messaging and the real reality of it is going to have to come true. And I think there's an opportunity for vendors and for innovation here to bake in, as opposed to bolting on, more security. And that's something that, you know, for, you know, companies like Google, you know, the internet search engine is free. They want as much information in there, and, you know, information wants to be free is kind of that internet mindset. And it's very, very different with this business.
Yeah, well, I'm a huge fan of the whole Gmail and Google Docs and calendar infrastructure. But I think that these kind of things do just... You have to put a little extra bit of human security, I think, in place right now. And I don't put every documentation or document that I create for work on Google Docs for that reason.
I think Google is very much working on not only this, but just overall enterprise security. Both Google Docs, Google Apps are very much targeted towards the enterprise. And the enterprise is somewhat new for Google, but I know major Fortune-type accounts that are shifting away from your typical Microsoft infrastructure to adopt Google Apps and Google Docs. So therefore, Google will have to incorporate a lot of these requirements sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. So let's transition into our guest Q&A. We decided today to pick a theme for Kevin to lead us in value-added services for the cloud. But I'm going to let Edgar introduce Kevin and get us into the discussion.
Great. So Kevin is an accomplished entrepreneur and executive with experience in software networking, storage, and security. Most recently, he was president and CEO at Kidaro, a desktop virtualization vendor, where he led the team to a leadership position in an emerging segment of desktop virtualization. The company outflanked large competitors to win top enterprise accounts, Goldman Sachs, Intel, Fox Networks, and the company was acquired by Microsoft in May of 2008. Before Kidaro, Kevin was vice president and part of the original team at The Crew. The Crew was acquired by NetApp. And Kevin, inside of NetApp, helped achieve number one market share in the global adoption across financial services, healthcare, telecommunications, manufacturing. Also, Kevin, as one of the leading experts in the storage security area, he serves as an advisor to the U.S. Congress Federal Trade Commission and the U.S. Department of Defense. Before that, Kevin was a founding member of the Inctomy team, a pioneer infrastructure software firm, where he served in a number of executive positions, including vice president and general manager of Inctomy's networking business. Possibly the coolest thing about Kevin's background is that he is a UC Berkeley grad, where he got undergrad and his MBA.
Go Bears!
There you go.
Okay, back to the show.
Kevin, you worked at the cloud before it was called cloud. You have a background with Inctomy on networking, caching, the Crew and NetApp storage, and most recently, Kidaro, desktop virtualization being a key underlying technology for the cloud. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to work in the cloud before it was called cloud, and as you see cloud today, and we start seeing a little bit of commoditization happening in the lower layers of the cloud or in the operating layers of the cloud with Amazon driving pricing lower every couple of quarters. Cost is coming down, which is a natural effect on increasing volumes. As these operators start commoditizing, how do we keep the cloud fresh? How do we add value
on top of underlying cloud services?
It's a great question. I think there's a couple of history lessons here that'll be interesting. So at Inctomy, you know, we were in the business of providing a big service in the cloud. We were the first search company to really be OEM for web search. So we were the seventh to market, which is generally not a great place to enter a market. But within 2.5 years, we were number one in market share. We had Microsoft, Yahoo, AOL, all of the big companies using us for the search services, but inside their own brand. So we called it Inctomy Inside. This was a business innovation that was important because when you're seventh to market, it's kind of tough to claw your way at playing the same game as everyone else. And so we had to invent essentially, you know, a model for how do you deliver this technology, how do you make it multi-tenant, how do you customize it, and then how do you keep it really robust. We would charge by the search or do a rev share on advertising. You know, this is back in 1995, 96, before it was the, you know, a well-paying business necessarily in advertising. So this was something that I believed in heavily, is that, you know, big important services could, you know, be born in the internet, in the cloud, and be delivered in multiple ways to multiple customers, and you could get economies of scale. The interesting thing here is, you know, we talked about all this workload portability. You know, we're looking at the pricing now. We're seeing, you know, multiple players come in. You've had Amazon out there pioneering this, but you've got Rackspace and IBM and Microsoft and everyone piling on. You've got a fundamental commodity business. This is very similar to what the telcos faced. They built these giant multi-billion dollar infrastructures, and then they would get in price wars for how much per minute, you know, do they charge you on your phone calls. And then the same thing happened in the cellular infrastructure, and you get these sort of minute plans and a rapidly declining price war. And in both cases, what they had to do is they had to really think of, what do you do now that you've got all of these customers, you've got this big infrastructure, how do you extract margin? How do you differentiate yourself from just the gigabyte months or the CPU hours that the other guy is selling? And what it's going to come down to is, how do you build intelligence and software into that cloud, into that infrastructure service, and start spinning up new services? So in the telco world, it was, you know, caller ID, voicemail, three-way calling. And then as it went to the mobile infrastructure, it was friends and family, you know.
Text messaging.
Data plans.
You know, location-based services. So all of these are examples of what you do when you have a big fixed cost infrastructure and you need to build margin.
But let me ask you a question on that analogy, Kevin. So if I take your two analogies on telco billing and cell phone billing, I'd say what that led to is not only value-added services, but a lot of confusion. I mean, if you try to digest your cell phone bill line by line, it makes my head explode.
Some of that's on purpose.
Yeah, so some of that's on purpose. I'm hoping that the development of value-added services in the cloud won't necessarily follow that model exactly, and that I'm hoping the technology bent might simplify things a little bit more. But, you know, what are we sort of doomed for that kind of noise of hundreds of different features and pricing models, and then how do we sort through it?
Well, you know, evolution and, you know, natural selection are pretty good guides in general. So, you know, this is how we've seen it in multiple markets, where you had a very high fixed cost, relatively, you know, small marginal cost, and low margins developing over time. People end up having to do this. Part of it is obfuscation, so that they can, you know, essentially, you know, pretend that their deal is as good as the other guys. Some of it is just innovation, that there'll be new services and new positioning that each of these vendors takes. So hopefully, you know, the messaging and, you know, some of the way it develops will learn from the past a little bit. But I would suggest that, you know, you're going to see people try to be different in a business that's fundamentally very similar. And what that's going to take is some creativity, both in terms of building technology, but also in terms of how they position and market and deliver it to different vertical segments.
So can you tell us a little bit about what are the general areas where you would see innovation come in, if you've thought about them? Not specific. We leave that to the entrepreneurs in the audience. But in general areas, what do you think? Where do you think we can start adding value to the cloud?
Well, there's a number of the holes that we've talked about already today. So, for example, take security. So this is a place where, you know, many enterprises themselves have done a bad job behind their firewall of really building security. And this might be a place where it could not only, you know, get up to par, but even get better. If done by real professionals in a way that's scalable and in a way that's much more standardized. So this is an example, security and compliance. And, you know, another one that you could envision would be something like litigation support. So today in an enterprise, you've got data assets sprawled all over. You get sued and you pay your lawyers millions of dollars to go comb through everything and, you know, try and discover all the information and produce it for the lawsuit. So this happens every day, literally, in big companies. They're constantly in a state of warfare for these legal things, and it's a huge cost. And so companies like Zantas have sprung up to essentially help manage this and provide an outsourced repository for handling that data. If that was built in to the way your applications worked.
Right. I think Zantas picked a great starting point with email. I don't know if they're also that service applies to all the documents that reside within a company.
Yeah, there are a number of services. I don't know Zantas specifically, but there are a number of services that have now scaled way beyond that to handle the whole gamut of unstructured data, semi-structured, structured, and looking across that. Because today, if you're a plaintiff lawyer, you're going to ask for everything. And that those clues and the data that you want are going to be hidden in Oracle databases. They're going to be hidden in emails. They're going to be in documents.
So is the idea here that we just take this example as a particular implementation that similar to the way I understand how Zantas works, where they essentially take a copy of the email offsite and store that separately in a way that can be indexed and searched so as not to disrupt the day-to-day business. Similarly, copies of databases or copies of documents or what have you will be put into some location in the cloud and then reside there with the appropriate level of security, but then to provide an interface for litigation support? Is that?
You could imagine a smart DR facility that provided both the high availability and disaster recovery and some of these value-added services for a fee.
Right.
And that being targeted at certain industries, let's say pharma, for example, that has FDA requirements and have to store things a certain way. So these are going to be opportunities for people in the cloud industry to deliver value in a way that has much more business value than just saving on managing servers. This is how do you do something smart? And if you can do it once the right way and then scale that across hundreds or thousands of customers, that's a pretty interesting business opportunity.
Yeah, and the thing that's interesting there to me is, of course, how do I get some of this stuff out of my hair so it doesn't affect my business, right? And by allowing searches and indexing and all of that about the data, if I can get over the fact of having it somewhere else. Once I'm there, then great. Lawyers need access to it. They're going to do a whole bunch of work. It's not going to disrupt my day-to-day business.
Instead of having your IT staff run around like crazy to sort of hit some 48-hour deadline that a judge somewhere gave you.
Right.
So these are examples of non-core business processes that drive companies crazy. And so not only saving a little bit of the money and getting some servers out of your data center, these are, I think, some of the opportunities to grow the pie for cloud-based computing because you can get more and more things layered on. So this is the customer perspective. It's not only the vendors who make software or hardware. It's not only the cloud service providers. But if you're a customer using cloud, I'd encourage you to start asking, what else are you going to do for me? If I move my stuff there, what are the other problems you're going to take off my plate so I can get back to making money?
Right, besides just the managing servers part, which is really what everybody talks about now. I guess it's interesting when you take that angle of let's look at sort of how humans operate and the way we run our business and what triggers these other opportunities where, beyond just I don't have to manage the servers, I get this whole other suite of benefits.
I'll give you another example. So think of all of the supply chains and partner groups that people have to do business with today. Today, that information goes in email or maybe extranets, et cetera. I think that there's an interesting opportunity to put clusters of information that are needed by multiple customers or partners or supply chain vendors, et cetera, and have a secure information sharing facility that is managed by someone that all you have to do is create a list of who is allowed to see what, and all of the enforcement, all of the auditing of that, all of the changes, all of the updating is kind of automated for you. So once your stuff is up in the internet and you don't have to let someone tunnel into your firewall,
right
now it might be an easier place to stage that kind of information sharing for your, let's say, your design vendors or your accounting consultants or whatever it is, right? So the idea is how do you use this liquidity and this better data availability in the cloud and turn that into an advantage?
Yeah. I think we're just beginning to see those kind of advantages. Just to bring it back to the personal user level, I mean, even today with things like Google Docs and some of the file sharing options that are out there, Box.net, others, it's you quickly come to realize that the advantage of being able to share a live document with somebody via email and a password is way more important than fancy fonts and formatting that everybody got interested in with some of the desktop-based apps. But I think we're just starting to see, we're just starting to rationalize and understand the value of that model. So there's probably still a long way to go.
Part of it's the technology changing. Part of it's the people changing. over a 5 or 10 year period, the people who are doing the work actually change, and they've got a new set of habits and expectations. So, that's another part of the equation here, that the people who are increasingly doing the real work in companies grew up playing, Xbox and Nintendo and, and sending email and surfing the web from, their early days. And that's going to change the way we use these.
So we've identified a few buckets of value-added services. We have a security and compliance, litigation support. We have search. We just talked about kind of a collaboration bucket. I think we previously talked about a security, which is also part of information sharing and collaboration. There's also another bucket that I think we all share common interest, which is the kind of the performance and failure monitoring for cloud providers. There's high availability in the cloud, and there's cloud brokering. I think those can turn out to be a lot of value-added services that enterprise end up using in terms of how do I, increase my ability by using multiple clouds? What kind of middleware do I need between, either for cloud bursting or for, again, increasing the availability of my cloud providers?
Absolutely. And this is something that's both a service you can sell, but it's also a way to sell cloud. So if they can provide you much better visibility into the way that your applications are running or not running, that might be something that, the CIO says, I never had this. I just moved some, HR application up in the cloud. I've got better visibility into it than my ERP or CRM. What's wrong with you, IT department? So it's one of these things where it's an upside opportunity to not only solve a problem, but then to really help sell the value of cloud. And again, this is where a big managed service with real professionals doing each of the functions that you can build something that's best in class.
I think this is one of the biggest opportunities for. We touched on this previously, measuring what's possible. I always say that, Amazon with their transparent pricing for all of their web services has really set a benchmark that allows anybody to compare, what is it costing me internally. And yes, obviously it's not 100% the same, but we've never had the ability to so easily say what should a gigabyte of storage actually cost me, or what should transferring a certain amount of bits on a CDN actually cost me, or what should a CRM application actually cost me on an ongoing basis.
Or what should the uptime be?
I mean, such clarity that it really should cause a whole rethinking of how people are measuring the deployment of technology internally, because I think far too often people deploy technology internally because this sort of momentum and the way people have done it, but I'm not sure for the vast majority of companies that they should actually be in the IT business.
Well, there's some simple arithmetic that's going to show up in boardrooms this year, next year, where you say, okay, now how many terabytes of data do we have and how much did we spend this quarter? You've got to be kidding. And I think there's some of that math that's going to now become much more transparent and visible, and you're going to have these benchmarks that are just posted up on the wall. And that's something that is going to create a lot of, I think, shakeup in places that are really doing inefficient.
I'm thinking tools for the CFO as well, right? If the benchmark is dollars per gigabyte or uptime, dollars, cost, those are metrics that CFOs are going to now use and say, listen, I'm not getting the bang for my buck here. What's wrong?
Yeah.
Well, it's always interesting inside the politics of companies. I think there's a lot of people that will love to see things stay the way they are. And you'll have the firebrands that show up, and with that math, it's a pretty simple equation for anyone who's got visibility into that budget. They're going, do we really want to pay 10x? Because that's what we're paying today.
Yeah.
And that's not even counting the time that you're spending and I'm spending. So it's a pretty interesting discussion that's going to happen, and it's there's a lot of cultural change and a lot of politics and a lot of that the wetware is always the hardest, right?
Right.
So shifting the topics a little bit, Kevin, what kind of things are you involved right now? You sold Kidara to Microsoft back in May. What have you been up to?
Well, I've been talking to a lot of interesting companies, and I'm actually advising a couple that I think are kind of interesting in this discussion. One of them is providing search across multiple structured data applications. They can do that behind the firewall, go into your legacy applications, and for the first time, you've never really been able to extract that data. For the first time, that they can not only extract the data and all the metadata, but also enforce all the ACLs and security. So again, it's easy to take data and dump it into a search engine. It's hard to make sure that each person can only see what they're entitled to see and make that an automated real-time process that ties into all those complicated applications.
And this is structured data.
Yeah, this is structured data,
which is the hard,
which is very hard. Unstructured data is pretty easy, and you know today, you know, so you know, Google and Autonomy and Microsoft with their fast acquisition and Deca, you know, I know the search industry pretty well from my past, and they've all done a pretty good job with unstructured data, or maybe even semi-structured, but structured data has just been out of the equation, and it's been a stunting of the growth of the search industry because a lot of the good stuff is in applications. A lot of the stuff you run your business on is structured. But the owners of that structured data will not let it go in the bucket unless it can be protected and all of those policies can be enforced. So this company is called Qplix, and we really like them. They're scrappy, and they've got a bunch of Fortune 500 companies that are out there doing it, and they've kind of made a breakthrough here. What's interesting in the context of the cloud discussion is not only can they tie into these legacy applications and, you know, get their hands dirty and sort of automate the extraction, they can also reach up to the cloud. They can reach up to your Salesforce.com. They can reach up with secure connectors. So they don't care where the data lives. What they're trying to do is provide you a 360-degree view that bridges across 17 different flavors of modern and legacy applications. So in, you know, 500 milliseconds, you can have results from all of the different data sets that are appropriate for your customer service rep. That's interesting. And, you know, one of the evolutions that I think we'll see, you know, there's a lot of companies that will start with this kind of capability behind their firewall. And if they have a lot of the data there, they're not going to want to send an index of that outside the firewall. But as you see more and more people pushing subsets or, you know, chunks of their applications into the cloud, having search there as a service, it's almost, you want fries with that?
Mm-hmm.
You want search with that? You've got these 17 apps that you've now put up in the cloud. Wouldn't you like to be able to see across all of them instead of opening up 17 different essentially clients or browsers or sessions? And so that's an example of the type of service that companies initially are going to provide on their private clouds, but eventually, you know, there's no excuse if you're, you know, Google or IBM or, you know, Amazon for not providing that kind of functionality that to stripe across multiple applications. This is how you hold on to those customers instead of having every app be this individual price war.
I think as a small aside, this is a great indicator of or early sign of cloud maturity. If you're a startup today, not only are you not supposed to build a data center, you're supposed to leverage cloud technologies in the back end, but also now in the front end, if you're going to reach into data, not only do you need to address legacy applications, but you have to come to market with connectors to cloud type of data, which is, you know, I find interesting.
Well, it you know, in networking, it's the OSI stack, right? And, you know, people focus on, you know, layer 3 or layer 7, you know, and what happens is that eventually you need to have solutions that span all those layers. And, you know, in this case, you know, we talked about the OS virtualization, then we talked about application virtualization, and now we're talking about getting inside into the data. It's these Russian dolls kind of nested value. And this is the place where, you know, companies are going to, you know, set themselves apart by delivering an integrated suite. You'll have best-in-class solutions, but what the big guys eventually need to get to is best-in-suite. And that's where, if you look at, you know, the Office applications, that's what made Microsoft rich, is they delivered a really great suite that worked together seamlessly. And I think in cloud compute, how you essentially enable companies to get business done, it's not about managing servers, it's about getting business done. And if you can do that in a way that is integrated and seamless with less problems, I think you're a winner. And there's a lot of, you know, I think room for innovation there as we sort of move those workloads out of the legacy environment.
So, Kevin, that was Qplix. What else are you involved with?
So there's another company here, which is back to that secure information sharing idea, a company called Qwak that is doing application collaboration. So they are essentially, you know, think of WebEx plus Citrix plus Telepresence plus a few other technologies. They are essentially creating these secure war rooms with voice over IP, with, you know, text chat, where you can pipe in documents and applications in a secure environment and collaborate across multiple work teams, let's say in, you know, 5 continents. And so the idea is here, instead of just being on conference calls all day, which a few of the listeners may relate to, and, you know, I did that when I was, you know, in, you know, Fortune 500 companies. You know, this is a, you know, this is a really tough problem. You've got big distributed teams, you've got all sorts of applications and data. People have no way to really work together on those. And I think that to the extent that you can make it more attractive to put things in the cloud by making it easier to collaborate and work on them, this is, again, integrating into the wetware, integrating into the business workflows and the way that people use them. If you can create an advantage there, I think that's pretty interesting. And Qwak has done a nice job of that and have a lot of customers that are starting to use this for distributed meetings, whether it's big oil and gas, people, working with their people on rigs in, sort of four different oceans. Or if, sometimes it's just people with, teams in three cities.
So is the value proposition a one-stop shop? So it's WebEx plus Google Docs. What is the differentiating value prop?
Yeah, what they've done is they've integrated it together into this what I call best of suite value. So, it's one platform. You can publish any application into it. You can publish multiple documents into it. You put them up on the walls, literally, and people can go together, with their avatar and look at the documents and edit them in real time together. So, it's a pretty different way. It takes the Google Docs mentality, but really makes it much richer in terms of collaboration. Putting virtual sticky notes on it. You've got seven different applications piped in there with five different experts from three different cities. So, it's really taking that, enterprise workflow problem, and increasingly companies are canceling their travel budgets. Mm-hmm. Cisco recently announced that it was canceling.
Yeah, all my friends say we're on a freeze.
Yeah. And I think even when times get a little bit better, it'll go back to like half. So you're still going to be in this position where you have to collaborate remotely, and you have to do it across much more complicated environments than we used to. I mean, you've got 17 applications, again, that you're using to get your job done, and that's hard to do on a conference call or an email. And so that's an upgrade of the way that people work together. I think that that's something that can be done in the cloud, and it can be done behind the firewall. This company actually supports both. But making that, I think of this straddling of the behind the firewall and up in the cloud, we're going to be in this straddle position a long time. The companies that make it seamless to do business across those barriers while still preserving all the security and all the semantics of the existing workflow, that's a winner.
Sounds exciting. I'm ready to sign up. For our listeners, Kevin, would you just give us the spelling of those two companies
Sure.
if people want to check it out?
It's at www.queplix.com. That's Qplix. And then Quack is www.qwaq.com.
Great, and we'll have that in the show notes as well. I wanted to wrap up with one question, Kevin. By any measure of the technology industry, you have had a very good compass for picking companies and technologies as measured by the success of the places you've been and the acquisitions.
Well, thank you.
This is a time when a lot of people are looking at options and considering new things to do. Are there any guiding principles that you've used throughout your career that you could summarize and share with the audience?
So it always came from customers. So I spent a lot of time with customers, whether I was working in product management or marketing or as CEO, and I would listen. And what I've heard consistently is that people will do things the same way until it's really painful, and they'll reach a breaking point where it just gets extreme. So security was an example of that, where they had just built all of this big infrastructure and hadn't built any security into it. And all of a sudden, they are showing up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal every quarter, and their bosses and seven floors up were screaming at them. And so I always look for that bleeding from the neck pain, and I think a cost of operations is one of those today that's gotten a lot more scrutiny when times are a little bit leaner. So I think that looking for places with these breakthrough technologies, if you want to be an innovator, look for a big secular trend, and then look for something that the big guys are missing. So, this is the discussion today. You look at the big guys who are, sort of scrambling to do the commodity, stuff, and that's a big job, and they'll make some money at that. But as a small company, that's hard to make a lot of money sort of, competing with billion-dollar budgets. So look for these gaps and look for ways to help them make more money. So you always have to think about someone else's business and then think about yours. And that I think, is a good guidepost here as we talk about, for example, cloud infrastructure. How do you think about making more money for the provider? How do you think about helping sell more for the vendor? And most importantly, for the end customer, how do you attack a business problem that's been nagging them and they never thought they could solve?
So, sound advice.
I refer to Kevin as my buddy with a golden hand. Everything has been worked out well for Kevin.
Excellent. Well, that was a great conversation. Let's jump into the final segment of the show on cloud tips, where we pick consumer or business-facing cloud applications, tools, companies that we enjoy. Edgar, why don't you kick it off?
I'll kick it off with a new app that I particularly enjoyed this past couple of days. I was stuck in a plane 4 to 6 hours. It's the Kindle app for the iPhone. Basically, Amazon released an iPhone app. Basically, it turns your iPhone into a Kindle with a small screen. And the screen was amazingly good. I bought a few books on the Kindle. I'm new to the whole Kindle world. I don't own a regular Kindle. I was kind of waiting for the Kindle 2, and then I just procrastinated, did not get the Kindle 2, and just got this free Kindle app
and have been a fan for the last week
or
so.
How much do the books cost?
They're all $9. $10, actually, $9.99.
Some that are cheaper.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a Kindle owner, and I just downloaded the same app. And I agree with Edgar. This is a great app. And I'll make a point of this back to the cloud infrastructure for a moment. What Amazon has done a great job of versus, you know, even Apple. So Apple, I just lost a song because I had a Windows crash, and I had to go back through support to get my 99 cents. Now, it felt stupid, but it was a matter of principle of, you know, look, I don't want to pay for that song twice. And so I exchanged three emails with their support. In contrast, Amazon, here's how it worked. I bought some books on Kindle. I bought them through my regular Amazon account, and they just showed up on my Kindle. I downloaded this iPhone app. I actually had my iTouch. And instantly, not only did the book show up that I bought on the, you know, on the Amazon service and on my Kindle, but it was on the same page that I just finished reading. That's good service. That is really making it seamless for me to look into the same content from multiple windows. Amazon gets it.
Yeah.
I also think it's a huge mass market type of attack. Not everybody's going to spend, you know, $400 on an iPhone and then $400 on a Kindle. You can actually just do it once. And what Amazon did with this free app is basically blanket, you know, bomb everybody who owns an iPhone, and now they're all Amazon Kindle customers.
A Kindle is an iPod for books,
yeah.
And what they realized is, well, could we use an iPod for a real iPod for books too? And it was I think a real clever business decision, and I think it's going to help them a lot.
There was a post not too long ago. I think it was Stacey Higginbotham who'd written something about that customer service will define successful web-based and cloud-based services, and I made a comment that is, if that's the measure, I think Amazon's got to win, because their experience in consumer and customer service on the consumer side is best in class. I'm constantly drawn to the shopping simplicity, and if that, by some osmosis up there in Seattle headquarters, works its way over, which I think it has, into web services, I mean, that to me is a measure of success. Well, I want to add, just to provide a balanced view for the non-iPod or our iPhone and iTouch users, my cloud tip for this show is Google Sync for the BlackBerry. And as part of adopting this work infrastructure of Google Mail, Google Calendar, Google Docs, I have gone through a complete personal work, mobile device, laptop, Mac, Windows, reorganization, and this little Google Sync application for the BlackBerry has made it extremely seamless. I did it all myself, didn't have to get any help from the experts in the company to get everything together. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to do a chart over the next month or so to show how I got everything together here. So my pick is the Google Sync app for your BlackBerry. And any other cloud tips that we wanted to add? Good. Well, I think that covers it. Well, thanks again, Edgar, for co-hosting, and thanks, Kevin, for joining us. It was really a pleasure and a great show.
That's great.
To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Quick reminder, we do have the show on iTunes, so you can feel free to subscribe there either through the link on the top right of the show homepage at thecloudcomputingshow.com. Or you can go directly to iTunes and search for The Cloud Computing Show. You can also email us with any comments you have to thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com. Again, thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.